We'll wait until everything's ready before we call your case.
I promised your bailiff I could get along without it if we had a problem. She was struggling with it. Thank you.
The next matter before the court is State versus O'Connor. Counsel?
May it please the court, I'm Dave Dahm, and I am here on behalf of Daniel O'Connor, who was convicted of serious crimes following a jury trial in a case in which his trial judge left elements of proof out of the jury instructions on each count. His sentencing judge was not present at the trial, but confessed on the record that he didn't know enough about the case to hear the motion for new trial. So he gave it back to the trial judge, who proceeded to rule on the motion for new trial in the absence of the defendant, critical stage in the proceedings. We're asking that you reverse this case and remand it for a new trial on the merits, not just for resentencing. I want to start, if I may, with jury instruction number 4. And on the screen, I've placed a comparison of the statute in each case with the instruction, and the angle here isn't too good. I don't know that I can fix it, but I got it a little bit better. On the left-hand side is the statute that is operative for each of these two claims. One of them, Section 28.318.5, has a specific provision in it concerning an element of proof that would commonly be called mens rea. Sexual contact has to occur for an express purpose, that purpose being sexual assault. But the instruction given doesn't include that element. It's completely absent. It only instructs on the touching. The second error, also in jury instruction number 4, concerns Section 28.318.6's definition of sexual penetration. And sexual penetration is a material element of the first crime charged here, which is a Class 1B felony. And that statute requires, first of all, proof of sexual penetration. The jury instruction doesn't define sexual penetration. It defines penetration. The statute uses express language to define what sexual penetration is, but the jury instruction not only deviates from that statute, but becomes legislative and rewrites the law. The words aren't the same. They don't mean the same. The legislature didn't choose the words that the trial judge chose, and the Supreme Court has been crystal clear that where a statute defines a crime, those are the words to be used. We think that's important because the statute says that the penetration can be reasonably construed as being for non-medical or non-health purposes. That was left out. And this is a sexual contact that occurred within a family relationship involving a stepfather and a stepdaughter. And it is within the realm of reason to argue that parents, including stepparents, touch the genitalia of their children and their grandchildren for reasons that are either medical or health related. So we think that instruction number 4 requires reversal and remand. Now, when we got to sentencing, Your Honor, the judge who handled the pretrial parts of this case conducted the sentencing. In between, a second district judge presided at trial. There is nothing in the record to suggest why that happened. In the brief, I identified and confessed the fact that there is no Nebraska law on this point. I also confessed to you that I couldn't find anything that holds that that is automatically an error. However, there is strong policy from several sister states and from the federal system holding that where that circumstance occurs, the record has to either disclose an exigent circumstance, the ill health of the trial judge, the death of the trial judge's unavailability for a reason that isn't convenience, or in the alternative, that the sentencing judge has familiarized herself with the record so she's competent to pronounce sentence. None of that appears here. There's nothing to suggest why this is Eggers to Tinker, not to chance. It's not a double play. It's just two judges. But we don't know why these judges pass this case back and forth. We do know that the sentencing judge was confronted on the day of sentencing with a motion for a new trial, and on the record said two things. I can't decide that issue. That's a problem. And the other thing he said was, I have to infer from the jury's judgment of guilt. And he had to draw an inference because he was absent. And in this case, the sentence is a significant piece of this person's life. We don't think the Nebraska judiciary is well served by that kind of a circumstance, and we think that's a reversible error. Now, that would go to sentencing only but for one thing. There was a motion for new trial involved. And there was no hearing on that motion for new trial, and this defendant wasn't present. That's a critical stage of the proceedings. He was entitled to be present. He has arguments to make, strong arguments to make, and he wasn't given an opportunity to make them.
So there was no hearing on the motion for new trial? Other than the first time when it was raised with the sentencing judge, and he opted not to take it up.
I believe that to be true, Your Honor. I called the record.
Does the order say there was a hearing?
And
counsel appeared and defendant appeared?
I think if I recall right, the order says counsel appeared. It may also say defendant appeared. But there is no record of that happening. None. And we're stuck with the record.
Do you have a date for when that... I think the judge said he refers to a June 29, 2015 hearing. Is that the missing hearing?
It must be.
Okay.
I mean, I...
You're saying that even though the judge refers to it in his order, there was no hearing.
There's no record.
There's nothing in the bill.
There's
no record of hearing.
All right.
I mean, that's as far as I can go.
Right.
I can't go beyond that. Right. I'm certainly not saying the judge fabricated it. I don't know if he used a form order and the language is inappropriate, but I do know there is no record to substantiate that sentence. And I know that there was no argument and no evidence that was recorded as having been taken. There were some serious new trial motion issues in addition to the jury instructions problem. In this case, a motion in limine was sustained about the admissibility of certain expert evidence, and that expert evidence was received. And I recognize that virtually every error I'm arguing here is one for which there was no exception taken by trial counsel. I get it. So I've assigned the ineffective assistance of trial counsel as well, and at least as I see that, it looks to me like if the court were to find that one of those errors not accepted to is so substantial that it would justify a reversal if there were an exception taken in the record, timely by trial counsel, then the failure to do it is ineffective and we win on that basis. So, Your Honors, I think that this is a conviction that should be set aside. The system should work. It should work the way it's designed to work, the way the rules require it to work. This person should have a trial of the issues, and he should be found guilty on the merits. His instructions should be correct. His prosecutor should not accuse him of conduct in the presence of the police that suggested guilt because he chose not to speak. That happened in the opening statement and in the closing argument, and that is reprehensible.
Does the record tell us whether those comments allegedly made by the defendant or the lack thereof occurred before or after he was Mirandized?
Your Honor, I think that you can find the answer to that from the police officer's testimony because he also described some of that behavior. And if I recall it correctly, I think he had been Mirandized. I believe he was in custody at the time. That, I must confess, is from a memory not as strong as I wish for to answer your question.
If he was in custody but had not yet been Mirandized and was simply on the way to the police station when he makes these statements, is that any difference?
There were two times, Your Honor, as I recall. One time was the evening of the first police contact before he went to the station. That was at the home. And as I recall it, the second time was at the police station. And as I recall it, the second time was after the Miranda warning. So I don't think
just,
I answered your question.
Just
to say there was one of each.
Just for purposes of discussion, if on the way to the station he makes certain statements, he has not been Mirandized, are those statements admissible?
Yes. In this case, the statement was, I don't have anything to say.
And can that be used against him?
Absolutely not.
Before he was Mirandized?
That I absolutely not. It invites rank speculation by the trier of fact about whether it's an invocation of a constitutional right, an expression of innocence, an expression of guilt, and all are equal probability. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
May it please the Court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. I'll begin by addressing briefly a couple of Mr. Domina just mentioned here. I've reviewed the jury instructions, both the element instructions and the definition instructions. Frankly, I don't see the problem with them, and I must confess, with all due respect to Mr. Domina, I didn't quite understand the argument when I read it in the brief. I still don't really understand it. It seems to me that the definitions clear up any misconceptions that we have. Sexual contact has to be for the purpose of arousal or sexual gratification, only with respect to contact, with respect to penetration. It has to be for a non-medical or non-health purpose. There is sexual arousal or gratification requirement there. But in any event, it's not enough to just allege that there was a problem with the jury instructions. He has to show that he was actually prejudiced by them. He hasn't, and I don't believe he can. With respect to the motion for new trial, I would simply point out that Judge Eisnagel on June 25th entered an order in which he scheduled that motion hearing on the motion for new trial for June 29th. Judge Young's order shows that the hearing was in fact held, and if you look at the bill of exceptions that was filed by the defendant, he did not request any hearings beyond June 15th. So because this hearing was held on June 29th, obviously it wouldn't be in the bill of exceptions because nobody requested. The only other issue I intend to address is the prosecutorial misconduct. The rest of them I will submit on the brief unless you have specific questions. To the extent O'Connor claims as a matter of plain error that the prosecutor violated his privilege against self-incrimination by making improper use of his post-arrest silence at trial, we disagree. First, it's not clear from the record if or when O'Connor was given Miranda warnings, but even if they were given, O'Connor's conduct and demeanor at the time of his arrest were not silenced within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment. Furthermore, the mere fact of O'Connor's arrest did not render his silence inadmissible for any purpose under Fletcher v. Weir, which is a U.S. Supreme Court opinion. The citation for that is 455 U.S. 603. A defendant's post-arrest pre-Miranda silence may be used to impeach testimony at trial, which appears to be what happened here. A review of the record shows...
Was it for impeachment, or was it used as substantive evidence of guilt?
I believe it was impeachment, Your Honor. And a review of the record shows the prosecutor did not reference O'Connor's silence. Instead, it presented evidence regarding his conduct and demeanor at the time of his arrest, and the statement that he made at the police department, "There's nothing for me to say," which arguably was a tacit admission of guilt and was consistent with his prior demeanor. It wasn't until O'Connor took the witness stand in his own defense that the prosecutor asked about his failure to make a statement to law enforcement. Questions occurred during cross-examination and were intended to impeach O'Connor's explanation of his demeanor at the time of his arrest. O'Connor's testified his reaction was indeed surprise and not guilt. The prosecutors attempted to impeach his explanation by asking why he didn't deny the accusations if, in fact, he were surprised. The prosecutor then made reference to that testimony during closing arguments in an effort to discredit O'Connor's account of the incident. Now, admittedly, some of the prosecutor's statements during closing went beyond O'Connor's silence immediately after the arrest. Those comments were improper. The state submits they don't rise to the level of plain error for several reasons. First, they refused the number. I believe there were only two or three. Second, the statements were made the statements were made before defense counsel gave his closing argument, so he was given an opportunity to rebut them. And finally, the evidence of O'Connor's guilt was strong. Got Christina's observations, BK's testimony, O'Connor's behavior both after he was caught in BK's bedroom and at the time of his arrest, and the fact that BK now suffers from PTSD, common among abusers or victims of sexual abuse. And same reasons that the state submits that O'Connor's corresponding effective assistance fails for lack. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May step back. Does the appellant have any time remaining?
He has 20.
Counsel?
I don't know the day that is the cutoff day for the request for the bill of exceptions. So I can't address that. I recognize that if counsel's comment about that date is accurate, it's worthy of inquiry. All I ask.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in today. Matter is deemed submitted, and you are excused. We'll let people get organized before we call the next case here.